It is Super Bowl Sunday, the biggest day in football, and therefore the biggest day in defense, or so the conventional wisdom goes. But the teams in today's game, the Giants and the Patriots, featured less than stellar defenses throughout the season. Here's NPR's Mike Pesca.
It is still unknown, and therefore still available for wagering, what color the Gatorade will be that douses the winning coach, or if Madonna will wear fishnet stockings during halftime. But this much is clear. The winner of this Super Bowl will have the most porous defense of any Super Bowl winner. The teams combined to allow almost 7.2 miles of offense over the course of the season. That's why you hear this argument as put forth by Derek Brooks, former Super Bowl participant and current broadcaster on Sirius Satellite Radio.
Right now, defensive rankings are judged by yardage. And, you know, to say that these teams are bad because they give up a lot of yardage is not fair.
Because the stats indicate that a middling to poor defense will win this championship, the Derek Brooks argument has become popular. Change the definition of defense. Many pundits say, if you let up 80 yards but only give up a field goal, that's good defense. That's a little like saying, if you crash your car but don't go to the hospital, that's good driving. But there is an argument to be made that we should be looking at metrics other than yards allowed. Take points allowed. The Patriots rank 15th by that measure, the Giants a sad 25th. And it still tests the age-old motto, a motto that is so ingrained that former Giants linebacker Corey Miller returned to it even after detailing all the rule changes that allowed for wide-open offenses.
Yeah, you can score 40, 50, or you can throw for 5,000 yards like guys are doing now. But I still believe at the end of the day, it's defense that's normally going to win championships.
How can that be? Let's look at the defenses by points allowed. For about the first 40 years of the Super Bowl, exactly one team that ranked outside the top 10 in points allowed won a Super Bowl. But recent Super Bowls have been won by the Indianapolis Colts, who ranked 23rd, the 2007 Giants, who ranked 17th, and the Saints, who had the 20th ranked defense. Three of the last five winners in the bottom half of NFL teams. Ah, but those were the rankings throughout the year. Note those who rise to the defense of the defense. Former NFL quarterback Jim Miller, in speaking of the Patriots, gives voice to a popular new criteria.
I just go by what they've done as of late. They've only been giving up about 21 points a game. Much like the Giants, they've shored up defensively as of late in the year.
The defense the Patriots puts on the field today will have a couple of important players who were injured throughout the year, and the same's true for the Giants. So maybe the current defenses really are a lot better than their year-long stats. And then there's that ineffable notion that defenses can tighten up and play better when it counts. Corey Miller says this happens.
Defense is mentality, you know, and it's more focus on it, defense more so than offense. And here's why. Offense is about rhythm. Offense is all about timing, not so much when it comes to defense.
Though, as defined by the stats, a mediocre at best defense, which got better in the postseason, will be raising the Lombardi Trophy. Maybe the defense will be deceptively good. Maybe it will have peaked at the right time. Maybe it will be a bend but don't break defense. Or maybe we just can't admit that a poor defense is about to win a Super Bowl. So whichever team wins the championship will be able to say, you know what? They had a championship defense. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Indianapolis.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. This coming Tuesday is the 200th anniversary of one of the most beloved storytellers in the English language. Charles Dickens' many novels, including David Copperfield, Nicholas Nickleby, A Tale of Two Cities, and Great Expectations, made him famous in his own time, and they live on as classics in ours. But a new exhibition in New York City shows the books were just the public face of a very complicated man. Tom Vitale reports.
The Morgan Library is celebrating the Charles Dickens bicentennial with an exhibition of the largest collection of Dickensiana outside of England. Documents, letters, illustrations, and artifacts. At the entrance to the gallery, curator Declan Kiley has placed a large reproduction of the writer's unmistakable signature, his name over an inverted triangle of squiggles.
Because one of the things that Dickens almost always did, right up until quite late in life, is use this flourish, at least three lines, sometimes five lines, slowly descending. What it looks like is a spring, springing up, kind of keeping his name up in the air.
It was a powerful symbol, says Kylie.
Remember that someone from his really relatively humble origins was later on, when he became a very famous author, and he became a very famous author very young, needed various support structures in his life.
Dickens began his literary career with almost no formal education. He was born in Landport on February 7, 1812, the second of eight children. When he was 12, his father was sent to debtor's prison. Dickens was forced to quit school and work in a London blacking factory, sealing pots of shoe polish and pasting labels on them. He would rework that hellish experience into his fiction for the rest of his life.
He was a social reformer who knew whereof he spoke.
Actor Simon Callow is author of a new biography called Charles Dickens and the Great Theatre of the World.
He knew what poverty was. He knew what it was to be rejected, to be cast aside, to live in squalor.
And so Dickens wrote with great compassion for the suffering of innocent and vulnerable children, characters like David Copperfield, Little Dorrit, and, in this passage read by Simon Callow, the orphan Oliver Twist.
With his slice of bread in his hand and his little brown parish cap on his head, Oliver was now led away from the wretched home where one kind word or look never lighted the gloom of his infant days. Yet he burst into an agony of childish grief as the cottage gate closed after him. Wretched as were the little companions in misery he was now leaving behind him, they were the only friends he had ever had.
With the appearance of Oliver Twist in London periodicals in 1837, the 25-year-old Charles Dickens became the most popular writer in England. But his first love was theater, and he considered becoming an actor. Peter Ackroyd is author of Dickens, Public Life and Private Passion.
And when he was actually writing, he became the characters. He would get up from his desk, go over to the mirror and mouth the words and do the expressions, the grimaces, whatever, and then laugh, chuckle to himself, then go back and write it down.
Dickens created 989 named characters, each with a distinct voice and style. Those characters bolstered his popularity. Every one of his major works has been adapted for either stage or screen.
Bah, humbug.
Don't be cross, Uncle. What else can I be when I live in such a world of fools as this?
A Christmas Carol inspired more than a dozen films, from Alastair Sims' Scrooge in 1951.
Why do you doubt your senses?
Because a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheat. You might be an undigested bit of beef. A piece of cheese. A fragment of underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave in you. Whatever you are.
To Jim Carrey's voicing of the same character in Disney's 2009 3D animated film.
You, the spirit whose coming was foretold to me?
The original 1843 manuscript of A Christmas Carol is on display at the Morgan Library. Dickens wrote everything by hand in tiny script with a quill pen. Remarkably, the manuscript is both the first and the final draft, says curator Declan Kiley.
You can see that the first chapter, Marley's Ghost, was originally going to be called Old Marley's Ghost. Further down the page, he's excised a whole section where he sort of goes off on a tangent about Hamlet and realizes, of course, quickly he's got to keep it tight. He only has a very, very short time in which to write this. He wrote the whole of Christmas Carol in 6 weeks in order for it to be published in time for Christmas.
Dickens wrote all the time. He traveled with a portable inkwell and a supply of quill pens. He was working on his last novel, Our Mutual Friend, on a train trip. That manuscript is also on display at the Morgan.
And Dickens had been writing this episode in July in France, and he was returning by express train from Dover to London and was involved in a fatal train crash. Several people died, over 50 people were injured.
Declan Kiley says first, Dickens saved his reputation.
He was travelling with his mistress, Nellie Ternan, and her mother, and of course had to try to get her away from the scene because it would have been scandalous if the press had discovered their being together.
Then he helps save the other passengers.
He helps the injured and the dying and writes about that in a letter that we're also displaying in the exhibition.
And finally, he saved his novel.
He scrambled back into the wreckage. Several train carriages had gone over a bridge into a river below. Dickens's carriage was precipitously balanced on that bridge. He crazily climbed back in to retrieve from his luggage this portion of the novel, due for publication later that month.
Charles Dickens died 5 years later in 1870, following a stroke at the age of 58. T.C. Boyle, himself the author of 22 books of fiction, who earned his doctorate in Victorian literature, says Dickens's achievement was extraordinary.
He achieved what any great artist achieves, a body of work that has entertained and delighted and instructed people down through the ages. I mean, that's what we all hope for.
Dickens's greatest fiction, says Simon Callow, is his own character.
People think of him as, you know, a jolly chap, really. But he was by far from a jolly chap. And, in fact, increasingly plagued with depression and a sense of hopelessness and despair. And that's worth knowing. I think it's always good to know that great creative individuals have, you know, their struggle, their drama.
A struggle that manifested itself in a dramatic signature and more than 24 works of fiction that have never gone out of print. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
This was the sound a lot of NASCAR drivers had to get used to in the 1980s, the sound of Darrell Waltrip as he barreled ahead towards first place.
The Daytona 500 belongs to Franklin, Tennessee's Darrell Waltrip. He's done it. He's done it.
Daytona 500. I won the Daytona 500.
Darrell, how long?
Wait. This is the Daytona 500, isn't it?
You bet it.
Don't tell me it isn't.
That was Darrell Waltrip in 1989 as he won the Super Bowl of stock car racing, the Daytona 500. Wins like that cemented Waltrip's status as a NASCAR legend. 12 years after that race, in 2001, he was back at the Daytona 500, but this time not on the racetrack, in the announcer's booth, calling the race for Fox Sports. It was a momentous day for the sport and for Darrell, and he writes about it in the new book called Sundays Will Never Be the Same. I asked Darrell to describe NASCAR from a driver's point of view.
It's hard to capture on television a car that's doing 210 miles an hour, but when you go around a Daytona track, a 2.5 mile track like Daytona, in about 46 seconds, that's where I like to say those cars are going boogity, boogity, boogity. They're going pretty darn fast.
What's going on inside the car? What can you hear? What can you see?
See, that's part of the experience. As a driver, you hear that engine, and that engine is singing a song. Yeah. You know, it's just kind of like notes are coming out of those tailpipes. If anything happens to that engine or if it starts to create or develop a problem, a driver usually hears it first, or he can actually feel it. There's a lot of feedback the driver gets through the steering wheel. That's his connection to the car, the seat of your pants. So feeling is important, hearing is important, and then connecting all that with the seeing part, the eyes. You're using every sense you have available to you to make your way around a racetrack. When you're out there with 42 other guys up in the middle of a bunch of, you know, a pack of cars, there's a lot of moving parts.
You and Dale Earnhardt had an intense rivalry. Can you tell me about your relationship with him?
Well, Dale was really aggressive. From the first time I ever met him, he was a young guy. Nobody ever heard of him. He was racing dirt tracks in North Carolina around Charlotte there. And he would put himself in situations that ended up wrecking someone and sometime himself. And so he became known as the Intimidator because when you saw him in your mirror, you knew he was going to hit you. Nonetheless, Dale, early on, and I were friends, and I tried to help Dale, and I used the word frenemy because we were friends part of the time, we were enemies part of the time, and we were friends in the beginning, but as time went by, when I got to be at the top of the heap, Dale came after me, and that turned into a real rival.
I want to talk about that day, February 18th, 2001. It was the morning of the Daytona 500. Your brother, Michael, actually ended up winning that race. And you were up in the booth on the air.
Yep.
And you were coaching him like he could hear you.
That's what brothers do.
That's what brothers do, even if they're on TV.
That's what big brothers do to little brothers.
Come on now. Watch the mirror. Watch it. You're going to make a run inside. Block him. Atta boy.
What was so cool about that was we spent all winter long. They had tested well at Daytona. That was the best ride Michael had ever had. And so Mikey and I were saying, Mikey, man, this is my first time in a TV booth to do a cup race. man, Mikey, wouldn't it be cool if you won that race and I was in the booth? And so I was in shock. My little brother, who had never won a race, is going to win the biggest race we have. He's going to win our Super Bowl. And I was beside myself.
The last lap. One to go, buddy.
And here my brother comes off the corner, and he's going to hold off Dale Jr. and Dale Sr. to win the Daytona 500.
Michael, you're in the best place you ever been in, bud. Hold her there.
And then out of the corner of my eye, I saw a black car, and I knew it was Dale. I saw it shoot up the hill, and I knew Dale had been in a wreck.
Big trouble. Big wreck behind them.
And initially, you know, we have wrecks all the time.
Yeah.
And so initially it was like, it's still all about Mikey.
Michael Walton wins. All right.
It's a television dream come true.
And then we go to a replay of the wreck, and I thought I was going to throw up.
I just hope Dale's okay. I guess he's all right, isn't he?
All of a sudden, it wasn't about Mikey and winning his first race. It was about, I hope Dale's okay. Because I pretty much knew he wasn't.
You found out that he died. You went to the hospital.
Yep.
And saw his wife there. So much of this is so difficult for the families. How important are the families to this sport?
Well, you know, I just got to tell you that this is the honest truth. You don't think this way and you don't live this way, but every now and then when you put those seat belts on, put the helmet on, crank the engine, and you look in your rearview mirror and you see your wife or your family, you some every now and then think, God, I hope I make it back. Because, you know, all of us that have driven race cars through the years know that sometimes you don't. But as you get older, particularly, those things really register and stay with you a little bit longer.
The book is called Sundays Will Never Be the Same. What changed after Dale Earnhardt died? For you, for the sport?
There are turning points in a lot of sports, and when Dale got killed, NASCAR, I mean, they became very, very aggressive. They developed a new car that was much safer. They created safer walls. All these things became standard on the race cars and in NASCAR after Dale's death. And since Dale Earnhardt was killed in 2001, he has a great legacy. But I think the thing that other drivers will always be grateful for is the fact that since he got killed in 2001, no one else has died in a stock car in NASCAR. And that's a great legacy.
The anniversary of that day is coming up.
Yep.
Do you remember it in any particular way?
I'll be back in Daytona, and it's going to be a little later this year. The race has moved up to the 26th of February. I'll never be in Daytona that I don't have memories of, not just Dale for sure, but Neil Bonnet and a few other friends that have lost their lives at that track. I always hold my breath. As a matter of fact, I'm more nervous watching and calling the race than I was when I was driving the cars. Mm-hmm. I worry about all the drivers. Just want it to be a safe race, want it to be a fun race. But it's different. I still long at times to be out there. You know, the old heart might say that I got the heart to get out there, but the old brain says, yeah, but you don't have the body. So, you know, maybe I should. I'm fortunate to be doing what I'm doing. I'm fortunate to be able to be a part of the sport, share my love, share my passion. And that, at this point in my life, is about as good as it can get.
The book is called Sundays Will Never Be the Same, Racing, Tragedy, and Redemption, My Life in America's Fastest Sport. Darrell Waltrip joined us from member station WPLN in Nashville. Darrell, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Well, I was thumbing from Montgomery.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
My name? It's Siri. I'm here to help.
She may already be the most famous personal assistant in the country, maybe the world. The interactive aide known as Siri debuted with the Apple iPhone 4S in October, and she's been talking her owners through their various problems and requests ever since. That is, when she can understand them.
Can I park my car in Harvard Yard?
There are videos showing up all over the internet of iPhone owners with thick accents.
I'm not aware of any appointments about haven't yet.
Being misunderstood by Siri, that was a Boston Globe employee with that distinctive accent. Now, here's Japanese.
Which email address for work or home?
Walk.
I don't know what you mean by walk.
Some accents work better than others, Indian, for example, but the one that seems to give Siri fits, and it's all over the internet, is Scottish.
Ask Siri to do things just by talking the way you talk.
We asked a local Scotsman to come in and put Siri through her paces. He's reading from Apple's instructions about how to use Siri, and we figured since we're talking about an Apple product, we'd ask a Scotsman named McIntosh, Neil McIntosh.
Say something like, remind me to call the vet. Any good burger joints around here? Siri does what you say, finds the information you need, then answers you.
So we asked Neil to start with one of those recommended questions.
Any good burger joints around here?
I found 17 burger restaurants.
Okay, so she got one. Actually, she got about half of our questions, but the other half?
How'd you cook a haggis?
I don't understand. Had you could I guess?
So that is Siri versus a Scotsman, Neil McIntosh. How do you think Siri did?
Well, I think since I've been in the States for 14 years and my accent's a lot calmer than it used to be, Siri should probably have done a bit better.
She should have done a bit better. Now, the phone that you're holding, there's a setting. It says United States. They do have a United Kingdom setting on that phone. Can we pull that United Kingdom setting up?
Absolutely. Let's go for it. Remind me to call the vet.
I don't know what you mean by I need Calbert.
How'd you cook a haggis?
Sorry, I don't understand. Hedge I could get.
I actually seem to make it worse, Neil.
Maybe that's my American accent coming through.
Now, here's an important question. Can you understand every Scotsman?
Absolutely not.
Right. Okay, so you can't expect Siri to understand them all.
No, you'd have to have a regional Siri that changes every 30 or 40 miles in Scotland.
Well, Neil McIntosh, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We asked Apple to comment on Siri's language issues. They directed us to their website where it says, since every language has its own accents and dialects, the accuracy rate will be higher for native speakers. I guess Siri doesn't consider Scotsmen native English speakers. From NPR News, it's Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Last May, Marina Keegan, a student at Yale University, got an email from one of the largest hedge funds in the world, Bridgewater. And the email politely stated,
we noticed that you didn't apply for our internship this summer, and we'd love to talk to you about why. If you meet us here at this time, and we will compensate you for your time with $100.
$100 just to tell them why she didn't want the job. Since her sophomore year at Yale, Marina has been bombarded with emails from banks, consulting firms, and hedge funds begging her to consider working for them. Same, by the way, with all her friends. And Marina is an English major. Anyway, she decided to take Bridgewater up on their offer. You're like, I'll take $100.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of students did that. And it was only sort of once I was inside the room that I realized, oh my gosh, maybe I'm helping them perfect their recruiting machine, which is exactly what we were doing.
Bridgewater confirmed to us that it actually does hold these focus groups. It's a small but telling window into the way big banks and consulting companies recruit at top-tier schools. And last year, at some Ivy League schools, up to half of the graduates went into finance or consulting. And it's a kind of brain drain that may end up hurting our economy in ways we won't see for years. Even President Obama weighed in on it at a speech in December.
And by the way, if we don't have an economy that's built on bubbles and financial speculation, our best and brightest won't all gravitate towards careers in banking and finance. Because if we want an economy that's built to last, we need more of those young people in science and engineering.
Our cover story today, the brain drain to finance and consulting, the consequences and signs that it may be ending. Now, shortly after Marina went to the Bridgewater Focus Group, she wrote about it in a Yale student magazine, and she found out that a quarter of her classmates were heading into banking and consulting. She was surprised and even a little angry, and it turns out she's not the only one. Reporter Craig LaMoult from member station WSHU went to Yale to find out how widespread the anti-finance and consulting backlash has become at some universities.
Take a stance! Don't go into finance! Take a stance!
These kinds of protests have been springing up on some of the most elite campuses in the country. Student protesters got into a Goldman Sachs recruitment session at Princeton and can be seen in a YouTube video addressing the student attendees in the call-and-response mic check style of the Occupy movement.
What you've been listening to is a carefully crafted recruitment pitch.
What you've been listening to is a carefully crafted recruitment pitch.
You can do better for yourself.
Similar protests have been held at Harvard and at Stanford, where Taryn Norris was a student. Norris and a classmate wrote an op-ed in the student paper.
When we sort of saw the Occupy Wall Street movement rise this fall and saw that this was an issue that the nation was really taking seriously, we felt like it was a really important time to step out and say, you know, this is how we think this is impacting universities across the country and why it's relevant to students today.
After he wrote the op-ed, Norris teamed up with a politically focused network for young people called Our Time to expand on that idea. They started the Stop the Brain Drain campaign to call attention to the issue and encourage public service and entrepreneurism as an alternative to the financial world. Norris stresses they're not against all financial institutions.
But the problem is that when you've got 20 to 30% of some of the top talent in this country going into a sector that is not necessarily contributing to economic and social productivity, then that's a problem for the country at large, and it's something that we should all be concerned about.
According to university surveys of the class of 2010, more than half of respondents from the University of Pennsylvania are working either in finance or consulting. At Harvard, it was 49%, and more than a third of respondents at Cornell started out their careers in the field. Norris says so many idealistic young people start college wanting to change the world.
And then 4 years later, they're going to work for Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. What is going on there? I think that's what we're trying to figure out and trying to address.
Goldman Sachs declined to be interviewed for this story. Morgan Stanley sent a written statement saying, quote, "Because a healthy banking and capital markets system is vital to economic growth, joining the industry at this time is a unique chance to shape how we contribute to a healthy economic environment." The Stop the Brain Drain campaign is only partly about the demand for new finance employees. It's also targeting the supply, and that focuses their attention on the career development centers at the top universities. They say the schools are too focused on funneling graduates into these jobs. Career centers at several schools say they confer employer-in-residence status on some employers. That gets them discounts on fees for on-campus events, and those events are promoted to students through emails, online job databases, and social networking. Allison Moore is the director of the Career Services Office at Yale.
The vast majority of organizations that recruit on campus here at Yale and at other college campuses across the country are definitely within financial services and management consulting.
Moore says they're just really good at working with career centers. She says the percentage of Yale students going into business and finance dropped last year, in part because with the economy, firms have been scaling back their hiring. On a chilly evening recently, Yale junior Jordan Oros walked out of a recruiting session that was hosted by the consulting firm Bain & Company. She says the protests and op-eds have raised a topic that students weren't talking about before.
You know, I think it's a really great movement, and I think that it really has started a lot of great conversations on campus about what we are doing with our time and what we are deciding to do with the opportunities that Yale's given us.
Oros says growing up, she wanted to be an astronaut. But now that the space program isn't as active as it used to be, she's thinking consulting is looking like a pretty good second choice.
That's reporter Craig LaMoult in New Haven. Economist Paul Kodrowski says elite schools have been sending a bigger share of their graduates into finance and consulting for at least two decades. That's not new. But what's different now, he says, is that those students have essentially used their talents to grow the financial sector and in ways, he says, are unhealthy for the overall economy.
So that's one, is that it's grown as a proportion of the economy in a way that we haven't seen since the years leading up to the Great Depression. And then the second thing that's gone on that's really unusual is that it's drawing in scientists and engineers and mathematicians, pulling in all of these very bright people and moving them to a use that no one really ever imagined.
Well, what are the consequences of that, if any?
Oh, they're immense. So, you know, one of the strangest puzzles in sort of recent economics of entrepreneurship is why the rate at which we create young companies in the United States is actually flatlined, despite, you know, immense increase in venture capital, all kinds of entrepreneurship programs around the United States. We're spending so much more, and yet we're not seeing any benefit. And so one of the reasons why is because of these entrepreneurs, in particular in science, engineering, and mathematics, getting yanked off into the financial sector, never to be seen again.
I mean, I'm just thinking about the last sort of 10 years. I mean, the iPod and Facebook and Google and all of these incredible innovations. That doesn't seem to reflect what you're arguing.
No, but you have to sort of look at it the other way around and say, how quickly has productivity grown over the period compared to prior decades? And the answer is slower. How quickly has the economy grown? And the answer is slower. One of the more remarkable things in last week's jobs data was, for the first time, a sharp, sharp decline in employment in the financial sector. So despite rapid gains in almost every sector of the economy, including, you know, wonderfully manufacturing, which is, you know, hugely important, we finally saw the beginnings of a contraction. Not to do with the crisis, but to do with a restructuring and a change in the role of financial services in the U.S. economy. And I think it points to a much happier future for the U.S. economy.
That's economist Paul Kodrosky. Okay, here's a pop quiz courtesy of David Leonhardt, the Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. What do the CEOs of Boeing, GE, Morgan Stanley, the Prime Minister of Israel, Chelsea Clinton, and R&B star John Legend all have in common?
They all worked for one of the three big, most prestigious consulting firms, which would be BCG.
Boston Consulting Group.
Yep. Bain, which is where Mitt Romney spent a few years before going to Bain Capital.
Right.
And McKinsey. All of them.
What did John Legend do there? Do you know?
I don't really. I mean, he spent a few years there.
Leonhardt says consulting, like finance, is still the top career choice on many elite campuses, but it's no longer gaining in popularity as it did all through the 1990s.
I think some students are saying, wait a second, if I want to make money, I want to make real money, and they're going to hedge funds. Mm. And I do think there are probably some students who are basically taking the advice of the president of Harvard, Drew Gilpin Faust, who's saying, hey, you know, I talk to a lot of students who tell me they don't actually enjoy this work. You know, I think probably on the margins, you have a few kids on either end, some of whom want to go make more money and some of whom realize they don't actually want to do this.
To me, one of the most glaring statistics to come out of the financial crisis was the extent to which the financial sector was such a huge part of our economy.
Yes.
I wonder if some of that creativity went into some of the, let's say, destructive creativity that we saw on Wall Street in the 2000s, you know, credit default swaps and so on.
Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman, had this line that drove people in finance absolutely nuts. He said, the only invention from modern finance that has improved people's lives is the ATM. Because, of course, high finance didn't spend a lot of time working on the ATM, right? If you think about how much finance has expanded as a share of our economy, and then you say, show me the fruits of that. Show me the way that has improved our lives. Well, you can't point to a huge number of ways in which it has. To be clear, you can create enormous social good in the right environment at an investment bank or a consulting firm. Maybe you are at an investment bank and you steer an investment to its most productive use, which is a cure for a disease. Maybe you're at a consulting firm and you help a pharmaceutical company figure out a new way to do things that makes life a lot better for people. It's a matter of scale. But one of the interesting things is people now asking, wait a second, do the people who go into these fields actually enjoy it? There is no doubt that some number of them do. But I think you can make a pretty good argument that more people go into this field than enjoy it, which is another way of saying more people go into this field than probably should.
David Leonhardt, Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. We also heard from Paul Kodrosky of the Kauffman Foundation. By the way, Marina Keegan, the Yale student we heard from earlier, she's graduating in May, and she is actually heading to New York, but not to Wall Street, as a playwright, and a play of hers is going up at a festival in New York this summer. What did you do with $100?
I don't remember.
You didn't, like, blow it on a bottle of champagne and caviar.
Yeah, I actually invested it in a hedge fund.
Now, if you're listening to me right now, you either hate football or you're in your car on the way to a Super Bowl party, because let's face it, Super Bowl Sunday is a holy day for many of us. But the actual game is just a small part of a week-long series of corporate events and parties. And it turns out a lot of serious business is done around the Super Bowl. Kurt Nickisch of member station WBUR crashed some corporate parties in Indianapolis to find out more.
Complimentary Super Bowl tickets are just the cherry on top of a week of perks. Scott Fowler has a room on the house at the Bud Light Hotel, the downtown hotel Anheuser-Busch bought out for the week. Food spreads, an open bar day in and day out, and VIP passes to concerts and exclusive parties. He's at the Playboy one right now.
People think that this is just a, how you doing, Frank? Just kind of a junket, a kind of a boondoggle and all that, but I don't feel that way.
Fowler is an executive at MGM, the casino resort company, which happens to sell a lot of beer. And as a playmate escorts a hip-hop artist past him, he explains he's here on business, to network. Case in point, 2 years ago, the Super Bowl in Miami, Fowler says that's where the idea for a deal between MGM and Anheuser-Busch's beer called Landshark was born.
Literally standing poolside, and my rep came up and introduced me to the brand manager for Landshark. We started a conversation. He was telling me some of his objectives, and I said, you know what? I think we might have a fit here with one of our brands, and here's what I think we did. That's literally how it happened.
Now MGM's Mandalay Bay Resort Casino has a Landshark-branded pool.
What I am getting for you, so we have two of your game day tickets, two tailgate parties for you. Everything is heated, so you don't have to bundle up too much.
At PepsiCo's hospitality suite this morning, a worker handed out bundles of passes to clients. Last night, this place was thumping. Guests lounged on white leather sofas and played the latest football video games. Now it's decked out with a brunch spread.
This is my 14th Super Bowl.
That's Andy Harkness, an executive at SDI Marketing. His ad agency does work for PepsiCo and usually gets more than 60 Super Bowl tickets to give to clients. Harkness says it's still hard to decide who gets on the list.
If one big customer finds out about it, were they invited? You know, then the guy down the street wants to know why he wasn't invited.
Forget managing expectations. Who pays for all this? Sarah Robb O'Hagan is the president and chief marketing officer of Gatorade.
You know, it's a significant investment in our yearly business plan, for sure.
Gatorade is not just catering to clients at the Super Bowl. It set up a sleek sports science demonstration center to show them the amount of work that goes into its products.
For one of our new potential retail partners to be able to see all of that in one place, you know, then go and see it all come to life on the field with the Super Bowl, it's a pretty cool, you know, connect the dots.
A connect the dots that can lead to connect the deals, and that's why these Super Bowl tickets are worth so much to companies. Still, Robb O'Hagan says it won't be a bunch of suits at the game.
There's a lot of business that's done at the Super Bowl, but there aren't many people sitting in that stadium who aren't really excited to watch that game.
Tomorrow, the hospitality tents come down. The Bud Light Hotel will go back to being a Hampton Inn. And next week, Gatorade will hold its first meeting to start reserving hotel rooms for Super Bowl 47. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nikisch in Indianapolis.